We met when I was playing the piano in my studio. She came in. She sang very badly, but with all her heart. After the conversation, there'll be 14 and one half minutes of music. Myra lived on Via Di Panico. I lived on Via Angelo Massina. Because questions are so tedious at these things. We thought instead of questions, we would have cake afterwards. There'll be cake upstairs after the music. We both came back to New York. Life went on. Life was full and full. Also, books will be signed after the performance. Also, CDs. A few years ago, Myra came upon a book in a yard sale. It was Strunken White's The Elements of Style. I'd like to thank the sponsors of the library for their support, as well as the bookstore. She illustrated The Elements of Style. I wrote a set of songs. We performed them upstairs in the reading room 2 years and 4 days ago. Thank you, Penguin, for your support with this piano and with the cake. The Elements of Style was really fun. Thanks, Auriel and John Hunt, for all the wine, which will be served with the cake later. Early this year, Myra started a blog for the New York Times Online, although you're not meant to call it that, you're meant to call it a column. She did one every month for a year. We'd like to thank the New York Times for providing the images on tonight's display. And 192 Books for carrying the books. Myra combined the paintings over the course of the year into a book called Principles of Uncertainty. I wrote three songs based on all the questions from that text, which we'll hear after the 37 minutes of conversation. I'm to encourage you to join the mailing list. Come to Newt Gingrich talking about the environment. The songs are scored for piano, countertenor, violin, banjo, and cello. Paul always says it, so I figure I have to too. His goal here in having these wonderful events is to make the lions roar. My great pleasure to introduce Myra Kalman and Paul Holdengraber.
There you go. It was beautiful.
Thank you, Nico.
So great.
Really was great. 37
minutes. So that's it. We're done.
That's
Let's have the
We're
cake.
Done. I've never understood that expression. Have you?
Let's have our cake?
No, have your cake and eat it too. You can't have your cake and eat it too.
I guess there are problems in life that come up. You can eat it, and we will.
Now, the thing is, I understand it in some way, because if you eat it, you don't have it anymore.
I never thought about that.
I mean, I think if you ingest it, then it's no longer there, but what's the point of having a cake if you're not going to eat it?
You make another one.
True. So, Myra, two years and 4 days ago, you remember? What did we do there? We had 37 and a half minutes, or maybe 39 minutes,
right,
of Dadaistic pleasure in the reading room.
Yes. And we've been waiting for, and I've been waiting since that day to do it again and to never speak again and to only have music.
Well, so and now you have to speak tonight.
Yeah,
I know.
That's okay.
And
that's
you don't love speaking and you do love speaking. But
it's
remember,
it's a conundrum.
Yeah, it's a conundrum.
Wait, there's a conundrum over there.
There's one there that we'll talk
about.
Well,
we used the conundrum in the, I guess a lot of you were there, but we used the conundrum in the opera.
With the Needless Word Orchestra.
Needless Words Orchestra. You know, that Nico composed for a bunch of knuckleheads who would
And the knuckleheads were playing what instruments? I'm trying to remember.
Well, we played the clattering teacup and saucer
right,
that Julie brought out. The slinky typewriter, Rolodex, jar of bottles with a bottle with buttons. What else was there? There were a million things. A mallet, typewriter. I think we said typewriter. There were objects that you find in, you know, passing, duck whistles, bells, things that you would like to be able to play if you were a person.
And what was so wonderful, as I recall, was that we did it in the reading room. And
yes,
we put an opera on, as it were, in the reading
right,
room based on the elements of style.
Right.
We broke all the rules of the library, you know, silence in the reading room. Probably we broke some grammar rules, too.
Well, there was a mistake, I think, in the program, but that's something else. But the you know, it was a...
You mean a spelling mistake or grammar
mistake? I think there was
mistake.
A grammar mistake, in, you know, in the
intentionally
thing that,
made by
so
you?
So not intentionally,
no.
Horrifyingly and embarrassedly.
No, I mean,
people still talk to me about it now. Yeah, do people
yeah,
stop
yeah,
me?
Still,
and, you
still
know,
now.
It's a whole legal thing. But the nature of making mistakes, I mean, one of the things that's reassuring is that everybody, you know, then somebody, some wonderful person says, everybody makes mistakes, mistakes happen. If you, you know, and so then you sort of console yourself that you're not the biggest idiot that's ever appeared in front of other people.
That's one way of doing it.
Yeah. One way of looking at it.
So
but the vision about playing in the reading room came, you know, like in one of those taking a shower visions. It had to be. So
well, I remember
so there
we
you
spoke
are.
and you said to me that you wanted to do an opera based on the elements of style.
In the main reading room.
Yeah.
What could be bad, right?
Easy,
what could be dangerous?
Easy.
Yeah, so.
No, it's a pleasure to do that. Yeah. And certainly one of my great moments here at the library was to have you in that reading room, a place where we never have done anything of that nature. And I remember people who work at this library talking about the dignity of the library and can we have, you know, an event in the reading room, which is mainly for solitary confinement.
Right. So it's like putting the Marx Brothers in the room. So this is up here.
No, I know. This is up here.
No, I'm not telling him. I mean, I'm saying it.
Oh, okay. So this is up here.
Saying the words. This is up here.
Yeah, no. This is up here. And we'll talk about the importance of certain words one uses and how saying something can become a problem in and of itself.
Big problem. Yeah.
So this is up here.
This is up here. Let's say it again together.
This is up here. Yeah.
And what it is I guess you can see, maybe you can't read, but it's Ludwig Bemelmans, and he is with walking stick on the steps of his studio near Paris, surrounded by his secretary, the chef, and others who happily cooked for him, served him at table, and continually voiced their opinions of his art. And he couldn't look happier. He was a bon vivant. He was a bon vivant.
And
that's what I would like to be.
You mean you're striving
I'm
towards
striving
that condition?
Like, it's like Eeyore trying to be a bon vivant. You know, it's like, it's not going to happen. But maybe. Maybe. There might be hope. There's sort of like the light is coming. But and so he's really an inspiration in a lot of ways to me in the sense that he was an artist and
a
writer.
Talk a little bit about hope then.
Hope springs eternal.
But you know that line, I think I've mentioned it to you before, that I so love of Kafka, who said, "There's hope, but not for us."
Oh. you know that he had every ailment on the planet Earth. He had migraines and boils and horrible things afflicted him every minute. Every minute. It was really very sad. And his parents owned a dry goods store, which is amazingly fabulous. Anyway, you know, this is the essential dilemma of life that everybody, you know, articulates in one way or another every minute, which is we are here now and are not going to be here at a certain point. So what is that about?
And
it's very difficult. It's an extremely unrelenting truth. And, of course, the way that you live your life is something that you figure out, and there better be comedy in it, or else you're really, you know, you're really a dead duck. But
you're really, what did you say?
A dead duck. Anyway, where there's life, there's hope. And, you know, I mean, that's always the amazing thing, that you are overwhelmed by the meaninglessness of it, and then you create projects and life and love, and it's dizzying and it's roller coasterness of it.
You know that I suffer from a disease called quotomania, and as you were saying this, a line came up to my mind by Albert Camus, who said that one has to love life before loving its meaning, for when the love of life has left us, no meaning can any longer console us.
And I would like to say that we shouldn't even have any meaning. That we should just love life. I mean, that would be a really good
solution
to the problem.
It's a flourish on Camus. No, it's good. I like it.
I've been working on that.
Why?
Flourish.
Why?
Because you can't figure it out. It's unfigureoutable.
Unfigureoutable. You shouldn't put that in a program. I think that would also cause. You know,
and so, what do you look for? You look for pleasure and a sense of engagement and a sense of curiosity and fun
and cake
and you know and celebration you know as often as you can in a way with time for napping in between. And I'm a big believer in naps and sleeping and escaping the tragedy of the day. I know what's funny is that, you know, I always talk about the things that we had in our home and that we live, you know, the Russian tragedy gene gets taken to Israel where the, you know, aggressive, phenomenally, you can't tell me what to do
gene
part comes into play. And, you know, a sense of can do. And then we came to America where it was all hell broke loose in terms of the 50s and entrepreneurial America and typography and language and hamburgers and, you know, not kosher stuff. And then the television set, it was amazing. And so we lived in this, I mean, it was really like discovering a new world. And we had Life magazine, Realité, Vogue in the heyday of Vogue, and Reader's Digest. Humor is the best medicine. There was also humor in uniform, but I didn't really respond to that. That didn't make sense to me. But because it was about army humor. I mean, but I took humor as the best medicine seriously. So
Myra, let's talk about what... I think we're really doing fine.
No, we are. We are. We're happy. We're happy.
I don't know.
We're happy together here.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, does happiness matter?
Well, that's another question.
I mean, it is
not
a question.
Not even showing any work.
No, we will show. We will show.
No,
the
we
work,
don't even have
but
to
no,
show.
No, no, we
work,
will show it. I mean, you know, look, Rick is there with the computer open, and you're going to change. I mean, we prepared this.
We made
so
all
much.
Kinds of slides in Russian and Turkish. It's crazy.
But Nico said 37 minutes. It was 137, as far as I remember. So we have
blankets.
Plenty of time.
But the nature of happiness is all, you know, also, you know, another thing I would say to my mother, you know, in my teens of misery, misery, troubled teens. I just want to be happy. And she would say to me, what is happiness? And I thought,
no,
what
I
a
know.
Maniac. Can't she reassure me? But I've understood what she's talking about, that definition is very elusive. And it doesn't mean that one isn't happy. I'm happy a lot. And the sort of the space, it comes down to fantastically elusive moments of incomprehensible serenity in architectural places where you are sitting at a table with a cup of tea.
Say that again. What happens?
What?
That serenity in architectural places.
The serenity that comes
places.
Into an architectural place. I mean, ideally there's music involved, but if birds are singing, that's okay too. That you are somewhere, you are in some kind of space that gives you great serenity. I mean, they're
in
truly...
Inner peace, as you say.
Inner peace. And you find those moments, you find yourself... No, the good thing is to allow yourself to experience those moments and to be in a place where all of a sudden you are filled with good feelings, not inexplicably, but they just come. Great, there they are.
Your mother appears in this book, I think, quite a lot. And we may get to her, but mothers are really important when it comes to happiness. I recall when I was 17 and a very serious young man, reading Schopenhauer or Nietzsche. I mean, we might talk about Nietzsche at some point, but
in depth.
I remember, I would bring back friends, and this one particular friend who shook my mother's hand. She kind of had a fish hand.
Fish shake.
Fish shake. And I remember when my friends wore dark black, basically. I remember my mother saying to me when they left, I mean, Paulie, I mean, do you have any friends who play tennis? I mean, she was getting... Now, one of the things I would like to ask you about, and maybe the best thing I could do, is really offer you and the audience here a definition and an etymology or an origin. Because it seems to me that one of my favorite modes of conversation, and also the greatest pleasure I get when reading, is in digression. I've said this many times on this stage, and I won't go into it again, because if not, I will digress. But one of the things that seems to me most important that I could ask you is, how does Myra Kelman come upon things? And before Myra Kelman tells me how she comes upon things, I'd like to offer this to you and then have you react. It seems to me less about digression and more about serendipity. And in reading these definitions about serendipity, I came on all kinds of things serendipitously. Is that a word? You think so? And... here we have the faculty of making fortunate discoveries by accident from the characters in the Persian fairy tale, the three princes of Serendip. And if you don't mind, even if you do, I'm going to just read this to you very briefly. Serendipity is the effect by which one accidentally discovers something fortunate, especially while looking for something else entirely. The word derives from the old Persian fairy tale and was coined by Horace Walpole on the 28th of January, 1754. In a letter he wrote to his friend Horace Mann, it was once when I read a silly fairy tale called The Three Princes of Serendip as their highness traveled. They were always making discoveries by accidents and sagacity of things which they were not in quest for. For instance, one of them discovered that a mule blind of the right eye had traveled the same road lately because the grass was eaten only on the left side, where it was worse than on the right. Now, do you understand serendipity? One of the most remarkable instances of this accidental sagacity. For you must observe that no discovery of a thing you are looking for comes under this description, etc., etc. And then, just to complexify things a little bit more, and
well,
also,
I need a pad. Wait.
And yeah. Also, well, you will need a pad. You'll see why, and maybe one of these pads, because I read in another definition that sort of adds on the notion of serendipity. Not only have some of the greatest scientific discoveries and serendipitous roots, many minor but very profitable technological contributions also fall within the category. Take the adhesive used in those very
popular...
Take the adhesive used... I've said adhesive all my life.
And nobody understood what you were saying.
Well, I remember when for a long time I used to say all bite, and then I discovered it was all beer. Take the adhesive used in those very popular self-sticking post-it notes as an example. The glue was found unacceptable by the discoverers. It was a lousy glue. A keen reevaluation of the concept removed it from the failure drawer, when the product was optimized by changing the mission to producing a note that would be easily removed from where it was posted. And I know there are these wonderful post-its for your book.
Who can live without a post-it now?
Exactly. So serendipity.
Ooh, I'm like the mule in that story. Whatever it is the good fortune to have the kind of system that allows me to wander around and wait and understand that I'm observing this world around me, and then I have pleasure in being surprised, being curious about a lot of things, and being surprised, and then being able to go back to my room and write in my notebook what I have seen, like a scientist collecting information. And I used to make charts when I was little. Woke up, check. Got out of bed, check. Made the bed, double check. I was really, I think I was always very neat. And I would make, comb my hair, check. And I would have these hugely elaborate charts of the most minute things, which I really wish I still had today, because it gave me such a sense of pleasure. And I guess that I haven't changed in that way, that I need to collect and classify in my way what is happening in this world and make of it some sense and then nonsense. I don't want it to make sense. I don't want to be a scholar.
The fact that making a bed is two checks doesn't make too much sense compared to other things.
Well, for me it does.
Yeah.
For me, making the bed is a lot more important than, let's say, getting a PhD.
Right. No,
I'm sorry, but I totally... it speaks of very different things. So for me, that is important. Getting things in order and making them solid and knowing that the things that are around me have an order and a beauty. I'm really neat. And it's paring away, and it's editing. And it's editing the world so that what you have in your worldview, of course things get messy and confused, and there are questions. And there's also things about judgment, suspending. How do you suspend judgment of things? Which is something that I would like to try to do for the next few years. Or minutes. If it were such a thing were possible. Like, I've judged everybody here already, which outfits are good and which have... No, but it's, and I'm sure... Anyway, I digress.
No, please, continue.
So I would like to... I would, in the sense of living and having things happen and then feeling anger or huge amounts of stress, but being able to laugh about it and being able to go on to the next story. But there's something about judgment and being critical that I would like to try to figure out how to eliminate from my system for a little while and see. Maybe it's boring not to have it. I don't know. Anyway.
Perhaps this is a good moment to look at some images.
Okay.
And I think, because I think we will find out how you come upon things.
Yes, and I want to say that when Rick and I were doing this program, I told him that the screen was... I have to say this because it made me laugh so much. I told him that the screen was vertical. No, what is it? I told him that the screen was vertical. And he said, are you completely crazy? It's that. Then everybody would have to watch movies like this. And I said, I know what I'm talking about. It's vertical.
I'm not sure I know what it is.
It's horizontal.
Oh, it's horizontal.
The image, so the screen itself is vertical.
Well, the screen is vertical, so you were right.
No, I was wrong. No, it's not vertical. The image is vertical, but the screen is horizontal.
Okay.
Anyway, I was pointing this thing at like my shoe, hoping that it would, move. So here, let's see. This is the first column that I did.
I'll say something about this.
You know, in the nature of serendipity, in the nature of good fortune, I think most of the best things that have happened to me don't happen because I'm just sitting in my room waiting for them, but there is a combination of what the work is and then somebody saying, would you like to do this thing? And so when Eric Etheridge and David Chipley and Mary Duenwald and Brian Ray and other people, when the people from the New York Times said, would you like to do a column for New York Times Select? I said, excellent and fabulous. And we talked about what it would be, and so it became this once a month because it was all-consuming, and it takes a lot of work to do a column. And so this was it, once a month for a year. David came up with the principles of uncertainty when I explained to him, when I was telling him what this was about, which is the fragility, the beauty, the madness, the tragedy, the euphoria.
And the title comes from...
The title comes from the uncertainty principles, which I can explain to you later in greater detail. The Heisenberg thing about physics.
Right.
He had 7 children. Okay. This column was the first column. Sorry, the rest unknown. They started out short and they got longer. So, I don't even want to... there's the dodo and then there's Spinoza. Spinoza is looking for eudaimonia, which is a kind of happiness, a state of happiness, among other major things that he did. But he died, and we don't have a stuffed Spinoza, but we do have a stuffed Pavlov's dog. So when we went to St. Petersburg to visit the Museum of Hygiene, we went there for the Museum of Hygiene, and then we said, look, the Hermitage is here too. Why not go in while we're here for a minute, right? But let me tell you, the Museum of Hygiene is really what you should focus on. Anyway, they have
a stuff. Say something about it.
What? The Hermitage.
No. The Hermitage, I think everybody...
It was after seeing that movie, Russian Ark, that's one take movie set in the Hermitage that had, Rasputin in one room and Catherine the Great in another and an orchestra playing. It was this dreamy, fantastic, everybody should see that. That's what we went there. To St. Petersburg, but this was in a beautiful palace that's now decrepit, with all kinds of really strange displays. And I like to go to science museums in the cities that we visit. And on this little stand was this mangy, ratty dog, and it was his dog. And it had the electrical box in its rump, and it was just there. And next to him was a photo of Pavlov on the wall, like this, eating lunch, like this. He had a fork and a knife in his hand. It was completely demented. And we photographed, and I touched the dog. And
How did he react?
He was dead. That was the point. He was dead. And so was Pavlov. So was everybody. But then we talk about Stalin a little bit, just a dabble, just like a soupçon of Stalin and how many people he killed. And that's a nice chart. I like the chart because it's fun to make a chart of... that. And then Nabokov, whose work I adore, many books, but especially Speak Memory, which is... this phenomenal book of his childhood. And that's him looking at a book of butterflies. And so he was displaced and had to flee. And my mother fled Russia.
Let's stop with your mother.
Pogroms. Doesn't pogrom sound like a dish? Like a potato pogrom? Would you like a potato pogrom or like a... Anyway. I'm sorry.
No.
What did you say?
I said that I wanted to linger for a while. It's a phrase that comes in your book a couple of times, I believe. So let's linger in the presence of your mother, if you don't mind. Let's talk about
This is going to turn into a Barbara Walters moment where okay. I will go, I don't like. No. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I don't know really much about Barbara Walters.
No, that's no. Whatever. But you know.
It might turn into that. But let's just talk for a moment about this map.
Okay.
And say something about it. But maybe even before saying something about it.
You're going to make me pull it out.
Yeah. No, I think you should.
I haven't done it yet.
Because this book, which we're, I think, a little bit talking about, or maybe not really talking about, but we will talk about it more, The Principles of Uncertainty, very heavy book. Have you noticed how heavy it is?
I tell everybody it's really heavy.
It's really heavy. But yeah. I mean...
No, but
I mean,
it's really heavy.
I don't only mean the content. It's actually a very heavy
book. The content is kind of light, but the book is...
Heavy.
Heavy. You get your money's
I wonder
worth.
Why. Is it because
why?
Of how it's
the paper
printed?
and the ink. And ink the weighs ink. A lot. This
the
is
ink
very
weighs.
Over... It's inked.
It's over
inked. Lots of ink. No, it's many colors. All colors are in there.
And, I mean, it's beautiful. I mean, you have
beautiful.
To...
It's beautiful. And
to
Peter Buchanan Smith, and I have to say the designer was Peter Buchanan Smith and Joseph Reyes. And they did...
But it's
know,
marvelous
it's,
also because you miss a lot if you don't take off the desk jacket.
And inside it are mosses of Long Island. Well, you know, you know.
Yeah. Well, but...
What?
What I do what? Want to say is that we should talk about your mother's map. But... There's also the map.
It's a fold-out.
It's
yeah.
there. I tried to take it out, but I couldn't do it very well.
Ah, it's perforated.
Yeah, but
Anyway.
I tried. I want to see you do it perfectly.
Well, I haven't done it because I say, this is a map of the United States. Either put it on the wall or put it back into the book. If you put it back into the book, it may one day fall out when someone browses through the book, and it will become a thing that falls out of a book because I have a section in this, in the appendix, and what I would like to do one day is just a book of appendices. With an appendix. Why is that? You should know.
I don't know. I mean.
Why is that word that word?
Oh.
Anyway, whatever. The I would like to do a book of just of appendixi, and appendixes. And that's word. That's a word also. Oh
See,
my
it's
God.
It's not easy.
And
it's just not easy.
Where is the? Look at this. This is
See
an outrage.
I mean?
This is a
But I didn't mean it to embarrass the publisher. I really didn't. Let me help you. There you are.
Okay. So there you are. Because I collect things that fall out of books, and I collect things that fall out of books. Anyway, this is it. Here it is. It's the actual reproduction of my mother's map. And I asked her to make a map of the United States. I asked a bunch of people to make a map of the United States. And hers was clearly the most glorious because she's out of her mind and didn't know where anything was. I mean, if you're looking, you see where Texas and California are. New Jersey, South Carolina is on top of North Carolina. The fact that she even knows that they exist is amazing to me, including South Daco. What was she thinking? What was she thinking? North Daco, Dakota. No, I know what it is. I'm saying, where did she come up with, like, of all the states to know or not know, North Daco? At any rate, and in the middle, and the most telling thing, you know, it's Circle, it's like, you know, what planet, you know, Lenin, the town she came from, Tel Aviv, Jerusalem is all there. But the most important thing is that through the center, she writes, sorry, the rest unknown, thank you, meaning, sorry, the rest unknown, you can go to hell, I couldn't care less.
Right.
And that is the point. That's the point. The point is that knowing the right answer is so not the point. Not that she didn't want us to know things. She wanted us to be educated and cultured and ballet lessons, piano lessons, museums, you know, all of that was really important to her.
But
she was on a different planet, you know, but in the very best, and I mean in the very best way possible.
So
she was like some kind of crazy philosopher who was stuck cooking in the kitchen. And we were talking earlier about Peg Bracken. Were we talking about her?
No.
Peg Bracken, there was an obituary of Peg Bracken. She died in the I Hate to Cook cookbook, which we were reading this morning. And, you know, because I start the day, as many know, reading the obituaries. And this was, she says, you know, sauté the onions, put in the mushrooms, boil the water, some other things. And then she says, light a cigarette and stare sullenly into the sink. And I thought, this woman's brilliant. And she did it, they say she did it 3 years before Betty Friedan wrote, you know, The Feminine Mystique. So she was saying, and a lot of the recipes involved alcohol, but not in the food, just like slug it down. She was saying a lot of women like to cook, but this book is not for them. You know, I have heard a lot of women like to cook, but this book is not for them. And the sense that, anyway, my mother was an artist stuck in the body of a housewife, really. And all the women in my family, you know, it's a very, very strong cousin, aunt, you know, unity, where the men barely get to say a word. And that's just, you know, great. And I mean, and the thing is that, you know, and of course the men always ruled everything with money. So we're going to get into a whole other thing about how that happens, that a woman like my mother is taking care of a home where she, I don't know, who knows what she would have been. She did what she was, what, you know, thank God she was there. I don't believe in God.
No, I know, we might get there. We might get
Don't get there. Well, okay. Anyway, so should we? What should we do? The next one quickly? Well, quickly.
Obituaries. Yeah. Did you know that Kitai died?
No.
That I found out just before coming tonight, and he was Kitai, a very famous artist who I had great fondness
Ron?
For. Yeah.
Ron. I'm going to look
yeah.
Ron.
Ron. Yeah. R.B. Kitai, mm-hmm. as he liked to mm-hmm. be called.
The guy who. Invented Rice-A-Roni died today. Actually, he died on Thursday, and they paired him with her on purpose. Doesn't matter. But
so
the point is that...
Sometimes they hold no. obituaries to pair
this
them.
This is the first I've ever heard of it. They specifically said he died on Thursday, and it was clear they wanted to put the obituaries to Rice-A-Roni and the I Hate to Cook cookbook. Oh, but you know what I wanted to say? That
say.
One of the things that we took out of the show was this image, and maybe a lot of you have seen it, of the, we took it out.
Which one?
The Japanese, it was on the front page of the New York Times
oh,
on
really?
Saturday. The Japanese, and just for a second, the Japanese woman who created this camouflage of when you're nervous, and has everybody seen it? It's like the best thing on the planet Earth. We're getting one.
Well, say something about it, because not everybody's seen
it's you can turn, I believe,
it's
a skirt.
About 3 seconds.
10 seconds.
But not if
you change
yourself
into a vending machine, a Coca-Cola vending machine, and you have these little feet sticking out. I'm not here. And and your child, you can turn into a fire plug. It's too glorious to even talk about. And so... And she says...
And that was in the front page of the New York Times.
That was the front page.
Below
the
fold.
Your paper.
Yeah.
Below the fold. Front page of the New York Times. And it spoke of so many different things. Of mad invention. Of childlike mad invention. Of entrepreneurial things, which I love. I love selling stuff. And making money from selling stuff. And...
That's always better
anyway,
if you do make money.
No, it's nice to, you know, it's nice to make a living from liking what you do in general. Anyway, where were we?
But that vending machine, there was a caveat
there was a
to
reason.
The 10 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe
and
there was
said,
no reason.
She said that in 10 seconds you could assemble this thing unless you're scared and your hands are shaking, and then it would take longer. And the image of, like, trying to get this thing while these people are running after you. I mean, what is it?
No, it's marvelous.
I mean, I will be happy about that for, you know, 10 years at least.
Well, thanks to the New York Times.
Thank
so,
you.
So, let's move. Should, well, let's
quickly.
Move. Yeah.
How much time
no, but
do
I,
you,
yeah. we still have a bit of time. We can't do it in 37. It will be maybe as long as a.
Let's do the impossibility of February because that's really sad and terrible. And the reason
the
that I like
the book,
this.
Cover of the book, but say something.
What?
The cover of the book.
That's
says,
the cover
yeah.
of the book. It's a photo of a man dancing. But the story my cousin told me was of a friend of hers who insisted on dancing on salt. It's just like some kind of long story, but anyway. And what I was happy about was that I have a typewriter and I could, sorry about that, and I could type on brown. I collect all the paperbacks that I get. I collect them and save them for some rainy day. And but then I thought I would type my stories on these bags because, you know, I mean, the sense of working for the computer... For online and handwriting, and then trying to remove it once again. Well, what could you do? You could type, and you could type with mistakes, and that could be on the screen. You're reading somebody's bad typing with corrections, and it's wonderful to type. Sabina sent me this package of this man, and it was a photo of an article of a man lying dead in the snow. It's Robert Walser, and he was a Swiss writer who wrote Jakob von Gunten, that Sabina and Michael gave me also. I have it here. And what happened was that he wrote a book about a man dying in the snow. And then he wrote some other books. And then he went crazy. And he was in a mental institution for around 30 years. And then he died in the snow. So that's him, dead in the snow. And I can't say it often enough. I'm trying to tell you that man, it's a photo, it's a painting of a photo of a man lying dead in the snow. Anyway, I read about Robert Walser, and it turned out that he had gone to a school for servants to be a servant in the palace of Dumbrow in Upper Silesia. And I want to be a maid for the Duchess of Devonshire.
For how long?
I don't know. I mean, that's the thing. It's not as if I'm going to go. But, you know, how long did he do it? You know, that's the question, is that, you know, so then you have this, you know, you're walking down the street and you have this nutty idea. Oh, my God, I really want to be a maid. And it goes back to putting things in order and having mundane barriers to lofty thoughts, which everybody needs. And so I thought, wouldn't it be amazing if I could be a maid for the Duchess of Devonshire? And I actually wanted Rick to be the butler and me to be the maid, and then we go to butler and maid school. But I'm getting some resistance from the butler side of the thing. And I think that I'm going to have to do it on my own, but I think I will. And I won't do it under, you know, false pretenses. I will tell her that I would like to do a piece about living in her palace, working there. I don't want to be a guest. I get bored being a guest. I like to work. And that I would write letters to my sister from my chamber at night by candlelight. Anyway, so so he's dead, and she's sad, and she's got a lot of hair, and she's sad, and that man is getting on the other man's nerves, and and the moral of the story is that everybody gets on everybody's nerves,
And I love this passage in this book where you talk about one of your fantasies of where is it now? I will find it. Of
walking around the world?
Well, that we might talk about walking around the world, but I love this, don't you? This.
Oh, yeah. Oh. I like that too. What is it?
Yeah. I forgot all of a sudden, but it's just marvelous. Should I have you read it, rather?
Whatever you like.
I'll read this page and you read this one, okay?
Okay.
Sometimes when I imagine my own death, I believe I will be reunited with my loved ones. We are all floating around in a fluffy sky. I get a delicious, cozy feeling. But then I remember that even my loved ones are sometimes very irritating and even infuriating. So what is that about? And what would we do all day, forever? It's good, huh? I was reading that last... It's really good.
So that's enough.
Read this. No, because
Besides, the whole thing is insanely unlikely. And I think about Bergman's Island, his last interviews, where he believed that he was going to be reunited with his wife, who had died, I don't know, a few years earlier or a few months earlier. And he was a man who said, I hope I don't live long enough to believe in religion. And there he was, believing that he would be reunited with her, that I couldn't sleep for, you know, weeks after that. Because, in the end, who knows? And I don't even say who knows. I'll say in the end, everybody does what they need to do. Whatever story anybody needs is the story that you need, and that's fine. So even when I say the whole thing is insanely unlikely, I don't mind having that delicious feeling, but then I do remember how annoying
they all are. Yeah.
And how annoying I must be to them. Anyway, that's enough. Yeah, I think that's okay.
Yeah, okay, that's enough. And so we'll move on
okay,
from...
Okay, wait. So anyway, so he gets on his nerves. And it's also about lying. And it's about, you know, the nature of language and how you handle language and all of the things that you say. And I'm starting to ask people, how much of the time do you either worry that you're hurting somebody's feelings or regret what you say? And most people say, like, all the time. I haven't met anybody yet. I mean, I haven't asked that many people. But I haven't met anybody yet who says, oh, no, I just say what I think and it's fine. And I actually, it's an interesting thing. Everybody's very worried about that. Anyway, that's Zelda Fitzgerald who went crazy.
Let me stop you one moment there. So what are you asking people? If the words they use wound others?
Are they worried about the words they use wounding others?
Right.
Okay.
And you're reading, you told me just now, Adolf.
My sister gave me Adolf. I'm going to make a chart of all the things my sister gave. Like, I'm going to make a different charts of all
I'm
the
sure
things other
are.
People gave me. But Adolf, which is amazing in its melodrama and its beauty of psychological insight into people.
And he
and it's
said,
very short.
It's
too.
Very short. It's
super 100, short.
Benjamin Constant, who was so important for the birth of liberalism, actually quite important in this country, but unknown now. Uh-huh. And he said something to that effect. I can't remember the exact line. I was looking for it. But he said something that to the effect that what we say, we cannot unsay.
Right. Right.
That speaks
and
to
that, you know, it speaks in our family, everything that you couldn't say, you know, the good things are evil eye. The bad things you can't say because they'll never be unsaid and they'll linger in the air, poisoning your life forever. There's never any, oh, I said something stupid, I'm sorry. That's no. It's like the curse forever and ever and ever. So the nature of speaking and then worrying about what was that sentence I said? What is the meaning of any of these sentences? Then it goes into who are these people and who are you? And, you know, then we get really lost. But anyway... those are the, you know, that's the question of speaking and unspeaking, and that's why we have music, thank God. She's dead.
Sue.
So the Countess is dead. They're alive. Oh, this is a Zen monk that I met on the street, and he gave me his card, and it said the Inner Peace Center. He has a card that says Inner Peace. And he wanted me to come for a tea ceremony. But then I thought, I was scared that if I went to the tea ceremony, maybe he was really, like a murderer. And then a friend pointed out, it's very interesting that the one person I'm afraid of is somebody who says Inner Peace on their card. And I think he's going to kill me. So I won't go there alone. But and then I thought, why does he have any more Inner Peace than I do? I mean, why? What?
His job.
Well, yeah, but how does... Maybe he's not good at his job. I don't know. Anyway, it's his job to have inner peace. And in my family, we go back to in my family, we had zero inner peace. And I don't think my parents said more than, you know, seven sentences to each other the entire time they were married. And but they had a number of parties. They were very social. And which is a kind of interesting contradiction. But there you go. And...
There you go
and there,
comes quite often.
There, yeah. There you, here we are and there you
here
go.
And
mocha cream cake was served at this party. And we want to make sure that everybody's invited to the mocha cream cake festival upstairs
afterwards.
From the same bakery that this is from, Mother's Bakery in the Bronx.
Do we have more?
I don't know.
I think we have more.
Well, one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
This is a depiction of
early dreams,
some early dream nightmare state of being, where you know some hardness of walls, some vastness, some
early hard, childhood.
Things that are hard and soft at the same time. You know that feeling? Something's very hard and very soft. It's like hardness and softness
combined. I know, Freud.
Freud.
Yeah, no.
I mean, Freud.
So, yeah.
We're trying to cover a lot of ground here, and it's.
I mean,
it's
no,
daunting.
We are. I really feel we are.
I'm sorry.
No.
Anyway,
no,
it's so daunting.
Think...
And then when we found out that he was having an affair with his sister-in-law, oh my God, that was too much to bear. You know, not to be judgmental.
No.
But
you know
really,
that line since you were. Had Fitzgerald, that line of Fitzgerald, reserving judgment is a matter of infinite hope.
Really? That's a good thing. Is that a joke?
No,
it's not funny. I didn't think it was
funny. You were afraid you were not laughing at
the
joke.
Yeah, because I
probably
didn't get it.
Sometimes it can be worrisome.
Anyway, you know, and, I mean, the thing is that if you are thinking about anything in life, and if, you know, then you deal with all of these complex things, and then you have to somehow say, well, you know, he was a jerk. He had an affair with his sister-in-law. But maybe they couldn't help it. Well, of course they couldn't help it. Anyway, at the same time, the guy who ultimately says,
well, he
forget
says
fame, you can't even say anything
famous
anymore.
Line, Wittgenstein, right? And you don't have a picture of Wittgenstein, but of his radiator
that he designed for his sister.
And because also he was an architect, if I
yes,
I
that's
remember
he
right,
made.
Yeah.
I think he did only one building, one house, right? Yes. Just one house for her,
such
which
learned,
is unlivable
such a
in,
audience.
Unlivable in.
The Tractatus, the line, the last line is whereof we cannot speak, thereof one must be silent.
That's it.
But let's continue talking.
Well, you know what's interesting? We went to see that movie, Into Great Silence, and which is in real time. You know, we're like with the monks for years, it felt like, but it was just 3 hours. And they don't take a vow of silence. They take like a choice of silence, which is, I don't know what's parsing the words. But anyway, when we left, I said, that's it. I'm going to take a vow of silence. We shall not speak. I say that every other day. There'll be no more language and no more speaking and no misunderstanding. And then we happened to pass by this new restaurant, Mirandi, and I thought, let's take a peek inside and see how it's going. And a minute later, we were, you know, with, you know, joyous laughter and drinking lots of wine and talking nonstop. And I thought,
tomorrow's another day.
Tomorrow's another day. And you can't, you know, what can you do but do what you do? So when, you know, even if you try to think of what he says, which makes so much sense ultimately, he didn't stop talking. He had a very nice time doing stuff. Anyway, he did the radiator was the house isn't good, but amazing, but harsh. And then I met the head of philosophy department at Columbia, and he and I asked him about things, and he said there you know whatever his stomach hurt him, and he didn't have anything to say to me other than wonderful things, which were just don't try to figure it all out. Just, you know, he ordered a crepe with whipped cream and nuts. And I watched him eat it. It was very, very moving. Anyway, we went to the opera. We talked about Pushkin. Richard Devereux gave me this book of Walter, and I said, do you know this guy, Walter Benjamin? And you said, try saying Benjamin anyway. But this beautiful,
well,
beautiful book.
You know, I love this picture. And I think we'll see afterwards the original from which you drew it.
Yeah.
And let's go, can we go back also to this one here? Some real changes here. Here's Benjamin working so intently at his desk, working on books. He fled the Nazis but did not make it. There's some discussion as to whether he did or didn't commit suicide at the Spanish border, at Porbou. Why did you draw him?
I hadn't put the Nazis in yet. And I thought, that's an omission. In every, you know, I spend most of the day thinking about, like, you know, the Nazis coming to get me. And it's a motivator. Because I have to feel like, I say, if I don't finish this assignment, like in 2 hours, the Nazis will come to get me. So I, you know, so I can get out of the house before they come. And it's something quite tangible, you know, so. anyway.
So he was
writing. I think that when I read the book, and I loved
this. Was Berlin Childhood.
Yes.
Yeah,
here
which
it is.
Wrote.
Berlin Childhood around 1900.
Well, he says something wonderful at the beginning, I recall. He says, to find one's way in a city is easy, to lose oneself is an art.
The fragmented memories that are so essential to everybody's life and so you know, elusive elusive and concrete at the same time. I mean, I guess it's a world of extremes. You know, that something is so real and so not here
that, how do you connect those, and how does that inform every minute of what you do? So, reading books and writing and sitting over paper and holding a pen in your hand, it's a magical experience. And so I love that photo of him. And, you come across photos, and I said, and I knew I will do a painting, but I didn't have the larger photo. Wait, I'm pointing to the wrong thing. So I couldn't put the stains, as you said.
Well, my 5-year-old boy saw this and he said, but why did Myra not put the stains? I mean, instead you put flowers.
Yes, I gave him a vase of poppies. I don't know, I wanted to. This is Helen Levitt's bathroom. And I guess I'm really interested in the, when you meet somebody and you see what you're supposed to see, and then you go off on a tangent and you see what you're not supposed to see, which is a sink or a bathroom or, under a something or other or a dish with some grapes in it. And those moments are very poignant. They speak of some kind of essential, personness. So she's not hanging her photographs, which I really love anymore. And she used to develop her and print her photographs in the bathroom, but she's hanging her socks there now.
Right.
And she's in her 90s anyway. It's bobby pins. I really love bobby pins. And this woman was wearing superior extra large bobby pins walking down the street.
Yeah, we've spoken about this, but it is. I want you to talk about this. I remember when I met my wife to be. I put her in front of this photo and said, "React."
This is the wooing part
this
of
this.
Is
yeah, yeah. That was a.
This
the
is like
romance.
The courtship.
I said,
"This
I said,
is high romance, darling."
I said, for the honeymoon, we went the first night to Paul Valéry's tomb, and the second night to where Walter Benjamin committed suicide. My father, life with you is going to be a barrel of laughter. But tell me, no, just this, this photograph. We don't have the photographer. It was taken in 1940 in London.
It's a photo, when I first saw it, I thought I wanted to put it in the book, The Elements of Style, because this was the quintessential moment of, if you talk about what style is, it's some kind of phenomenal courage and ability to transcend whatever is going on. So here it's after the Blitz, and these men, they're looking very elegant, very
wearing
chic,
their bowler hats.
And so the sense of somehow this moment of Where are you going?
I just think it's so amazing.
Yeah. It's really... And I have blow-ups of it and postcards. I mean, I have it in every form, on a T-shirt. So I decided that it didn't go into the Elements of Style, but it did make sense to go into this book. And it was really hard painting all the rubble, but... persevered.
And it's fabulous. I mean, we included also in another publication, and there you wrote, here you have, this is a painting of a photo taken in London in 1940. It is a library that was bombed in the Blitz, but you also wrote, this is a painting of a photo taken in 1940 during the London Blitz, another horrific attack on humanity, yet here we see people venturing out with quiet and touching elegance to reach through the rubble for books. Hope prevails. Hope.
Hope. You're right.
And here we are in a library. It's interesting
here we are,
in that way.
With exalted books.
And I think also, since you're interested in obituaries, is that wonderful line by an African poet who said that when an old man dies, a library disappears with him. I don't know why. Anyway, yeah.
Do we have more? Yes. Anyway, we've come to the end of these columns.
Yeah.
And I think, what do you think?
Well, I think I should probably ask you the one question that most people are waiting for me to ask you, which is, what about Nietzsche's mustache led you to Paris?
It's always, and Nietzsche, somebody, I wrote that Nietzsche's mustache, you know, was really this insane size. It covered his whole mouth. And how, you know, how could you believe anything he says when he has a mustache like that? And then somebody wrote back and said, oh, you have no understanding at all of anything. And he had that mustache only after he was crazy or something happened. Anyway, I was reading some philosophy that I couldn't understand a word of. And the antidote to that is to dash off to, you know, someplace and have a nice time. I mean, I don't think that not understanding something is it means that I should understand it. Anyway, you know, so I prefer to have a pleasant time than to try to unravel erudite things that I, you know, I could kill myself trying to figure out. I don't understand a word of Spinoza. Not a word. But I love the idea of him, and I, you know, and I wish I could come and sit with him and, you know, have some chicken soup, but I can't. I can't penetrate those barriers, so I go to what I can do, which is to just wander around and to observe.
We'll always have Paris.
Well, and the pâté. And miserable dreams, and, you know, and then recovery and resurrection.
Well, but my own thought at this moment is that we have been speaking for 37 minutes.
Is it 37?
Yeah. But maybe you want to say something, I mean, just in closing about this, because you were very intent on having this here, right? And why?
Well, this is a funny story, but I'll tell you really quickly. We were supposed to go to see a very, very, very miserable, sad play at BAM on Saturday night of a brilliant Israeli playwright translated completely in Polish by a Polish group. I think set in a concentration camp or something really, I don't know what it was. No? It wasn't? Anyway. What happened was...
It was not in a concentration
I don't know,
camp,
but it was
no.
Something really, really sad. And it was 3 hours with no intermission. This is the point is, it was 3 hours with no intermission. And six of us went there trembling. But the good news is my sister, who had ordered the tickets, went to get the tickets and they didn't have them. And we were like euphoric beyond understanding. Whoa! So next door to the Harvey is a, as we like to say, 99 cent and more.
Or more
store. So all six of us went in there, and we decided we were each going to buy a product, and then we would have like a fantastic happy grab bag of, you know, productness. But it could only cost 99 cents. And then there was a sign inside there, handwritten, that said, sorry, prices are higher than 99 cents for reasons beyond our control. Talk about like Spinoza. So I ran around and I got this like giant, horrible ponytail and some other things. But then I saw Dreamwhip and I said, I knew that this was my major product. And it says, savor the amazing possibilities. And, you know, the other side is Arabic, which I love. And Nico translated
it.
He can read it. He was saying it's a dream whippa. Which sounds Japanese. But anyway, he did it. He can do it later.
Maybe he can do it,
Anyway, it's a whipped topping mix. You know, I love packaging and all these things, but it's savor the amazing possibilities. Okay,
so
that's
savor
all.
The amazing possibilities.
And I like, you know, paintings of...
So let's bring Nico to
so this
save
is a piece. Did he say it's a piece? It's one song of three parts and all the questions. I think he said that in his fantastic introduction.
No, he did. But say something, because this is the second time. The Elements of Style was the first time that you commissioned a piece to illustrate, as it were, what you're doing on paper, to bring it to life in a different way.
You know, I'm alone a lot in the studio, and I start to sing to myself, and there's music, which is really primary. And then I think of Nico, and I know that we're going to collaborate, because we met when he was 12. And I thought, this is somebody who is completely amazing. And he understands the subtleties and the in-betweens and the weirdness. And the conversation is fantastic. And he made amazingly beautiful music for tonight.
Composed and performed for the first time performed for the first time
last,
tonight.
No, maybe not the last.
I mean, we actually spoke about that.
Ideally, it would be some kind of giant Tanztheater extravaganza, you know, with Pina Bausch or without, whatever she wants.
Right.
You know, we're going to give her a choice.
Yeah.
But the sense that we can take these steps and go forward to make music, and which would be the ultimately wonderful thing, and that would be what I would like to do, would be to be in that world.
Well, in that world, we won't need to speak anymore. We can just listen to the music.
Right, right.
I think the musicians should be coming soon, or maybe they're not coming.
Maybe we'll call,
maybe we'll clap for them.
Should we go?
No, let's stay here a minute. You want to go and get them?
No, I think they should be coming.
They want to still tune. So
we're going to get off the stage.
Right. We're going to get off the stage, but you still need to tune a little bit, right? Yeah. So while they tune, I suggest we move.
Thank you for the wine and the cheese.
Yeah, thank you for this conversation, Myra.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure. And do come for the cake and champagne and wine. We're not taking questions because we figured that you would prefer cake to questions. So shall we move out of the way? No, we can stay here.
No.
What do you think?
I think we should go down so we can watch the performance, which would be pretty amazing.
I'll leave this here. You can turn me off, actually.
Who are you?
possible.
He found God in the details. Would Jesus.